Hey, welcome along to another one of our Clubland Q&As. We are live around the planet. It is 4 p.m. in my mountain vastness in the north country of northern New England. It is 9 p.m. in the British Isles, 10 p.m. in Europe, 11 p.m. in the Middle East, some god-awful hour of the night in Asia. A bit of an early start for our Australian listeners and a somewhat more civilized hour of Wednesday morning for Mark Stein Club members in New Zealand and the Pacific. But wherever you are around the globe, welcome along. And I said for this edition, sometimes we do themed editions and sometimes we do kind of open line editions, but I thought for this one, we would kind of do something in between. And I'm interested specifically in quite a broad theme, which is the contempt that the elites have, the people who form not only the political class, but the other supporting institutions in society, the educational establishments, the media, the mainstream churches, a whole bunch of stuff. That they have for the people they purport to rule. It is a very unusual period in human history in that sense, in which the manners of the elite are more homogeneous than they have ever been in any time, and the gap between them and everybody else seems to be widening. And as I suggested earlier, that's present in the Harvey Weinstein story, in the NFL national anthem story, in the reactions to the attack in Las Vegas, and overseas too, in the Australian same-sex marriage debate. And I quoted earlier this morning Tony Abbott, the former Australian Prime Minister, speaking on climate change to Nigel Lawson's Global Warming Foundation in London last night. Tony Abbott said, "Civilizational self-doubt is everywhere. We believe in everyone but ourselves, and everything is taken seriously except that which used to be." I'll give you an example of this. The Fraser Institute in Canada and the Cato Institute in the United States, every year they've published their rankings of economic freedom around the world. And here is the rankings for this year, the top 10. I'll do them like they do Miss America in reverse order. Or the hit parade. Number 10, Estonia. Number 9, Australia. Number 8, Georgia. Number 7, Mauritius. Number 6, the United Kingdom. Number 5, Ireland. Number 4, Switzerland. Number 3, New Zealand. Number 2, Singapore. And number 1... the economically freest place on the planet, according to the annual rankings of the Cato Institute and the Fraser Institute, Hong Kong. So that's the top 10. If you're wondering where the United States came, they're just bubbling under the top 10, as Casey Kasem would say, at hit sound number 11. If you're wondering where the Dominion of Canada is, that's also bubbling under the top 10, tied with the United States at hit sound number 11. So that's the top 12 economically freest places on Earth. And do you notice something that they might have in common? I'll just go through them again, this time from number 1 down to number 12, or number 11 equal. Hong Kong, Singapore, New Zealand, Switzerland, Ireland, United Kingdom, Mauritius, Georgia, Australia, Estonia, Canada, United States. What do they have in common? Well, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 9 of those 12 economically freest countries are countries that are either current or former realms of the British Crown. Hong Kong, Singapore, New Zealand, Ireland, the United Kingdom, Mauritius, Australia, Canada, and the United States. And there's just 3 other places. Switzerland, and then 2 places that recently cast off the yoke of Soviet communism and so are a little bit more gung-ho for capitalism red in tooth and claw than your average Scandinavian social democracy is. But 9 of those countries are current or former members of the British Empire and the British Commonwealth, which is remarkable. So Tony Abbott is right. What's up with this civilizational doubt? The best thing that can happen to you is that you have either been settled or colonized by England, and that you have English ideas of liberty somewhere in your foundational, somewhere in your societal DNA. And if you don't, it's a lot tougher to create conditions by which people are able to fulfill their economic potential, although obviously Switzerland has no danger doing it. So why do we have a situation where the people who rule us are mired in a form of contempt for our inheritance, which takes various forms, including whether or not it's you see it in something like whether or not people will even stand for the national anthem at an NFL game. That's something else I want to talk about today at some point, because that in itself is interesting me. I have absolutely no reason to be interested in American football. I can barely watch 2 minutes of it. Its appeal completely eludes me. Don't get me started. I prefer baseball. I can see the attraction of that, but I'm not a big NFL guy. I understand it's the national game, but what is striking to me is the gulf, the profound gulf, the really quite extraordinary gulf between the owners and the players and the way they look at the world and their fan base. So in that sense, it is, I think, a relevant to what we're talking about here, which is the gulf between the elites and the people they govern. John Fry says, "You're right, of course, Mark. The Western elites realized over a century ago when it was possible for more than just royalty to not have to work for a living, that the destruction of morality was essential for them to indulge themselves however they wished. Has any society gone down that chute ever recovered?" Well, you know, society, that's too pessimistic a way of looking at it. The man to talk to here is William Wilberforce, and I'm not referring to what he did in getting slavery abolished, but what he did before that, the London of the late 18th century, for example, that he knew well, was at least as amoral in some ways as our own time. Child prostitutes were common in London. Some extraordinary percentage, like 40% of teenage girls in London were working as child prostitutes, an extraordinary percentage. And when it's that high, it means that it's accepted as common a feature of life as the sea or the sky or the trees or the ground or whatever. And yet William Wilberforce managed to effect a change in manners whereby it became unacceptable for people to make money off child prostitution, and then you stop seeing child prostitutes. And that's how we got the so-called talk about Victorian prudery and all these apocryphal stories about how the Victorians covered the legs of their pianos because they were too curvy and they reminded people of real female legs and all that kind of nonsense. The fact is there was a reaction. And the difference between the late 18th and the 19th century is the work accomplished by men like William Wilberforce in taking things that people accepted, because most people are not brave. Most people are not courageous. So if something seems to be all around you, you go along with it. And that's not to make any moral judgments about it. It's simply to make an observation about the state of humanity. That if slavery appears to be accepted by the people who run your society, you accept slavery. And it's a very small number of atypical people who create the conditions whereby slavery becomes morally objectionable. That's the same with abortion. If abortion appears to be easy and respectable and you pass the Planned Parenthood clinic as you drive home every night, you accept abortion. Well, we see it in Australia, where in a certain sense, the generality of the public is being intimidated into accepting same-sex marriage as a sign of what it means to be an evolved and functioning society. And the people who get, and so it's not a numbers game. The people who create the conditions by which those things change are a very small and largely unrepresentative type of person, very untypical in that sense. Thank you to John Fry for that question. Let's have a look and see what other kind of questions we got. I've got a few technical. It doesn't seem to be displaying in with quite the ease with which it used to be. I'll try and struggle through and see if I can find your questions. But put them in the comment field as we go along, and I'll see if I can get them. I'm having a few technical issues here. Hello, Mark. I belong to a visible minority group, Hindus of Canada. This is from Raj S. Raj says, I belong to a visible minority group, the Hindus of Canada, who are not in the victimhood industry. In your opinion, what is in store for well-assimilated and law-abiding immigrants like us in the event of the collapse of nation-states and Western civilization? And actually, Raj is quite right there. There's a big difference. And you understand this every time you walk through almost any city in Canada or the United Kingdom. Actually, in the United States increasingly these days, the difference in the degree of assimilation between Hindu immigrants and, say, Muslim immigrants. And in fact, you don't even have to leave the home turf. You can actually just look at the Indian subcontinent and what happened after the creation of India and Pakistan in 1948. And India is the world's largest democracy, a pluralistic society, the world's biggest democratic society, a secular pluralist society that's economically booming, as you know, if you ever go for tech support, whereas Pakistan has gone backwards since over the last almost 70 years, so that it has dug itself into Sharia and an explicitly Islamic confessional state that is at odds with everything that is going on the Indian side of the border. And you're right to be concerned, Raj. And I think as societies, as Europe, for example, Islamizes, I think people will actually retreat into self-segregating tribal identities more and more. And so, in a sense, what Hindus have done in the United Kingdom or Canada or the United States is a particular moment of late 20th century history, and that one of the effects of having a consciously self-segregating group as your fastest growing demographic, which is what Islam is in Europe and in Canada, is that it will lead to other people taking self-segregationist and tribalist identities. And I think that will be sad for the world when that happens, and that we will miss the days when you could go into some grim English northern town at a quarter of midnight on a Friday night and have go into the local curry house, and everyone would be in there whooping it up and having a good time and washing down their vindaloo with some pint of warm English beer. The multicultural moment will look to be just a moment. Jack Shaw writes, also from Canada, do you have any better words to describe the left than the following? And is there a psychological condition, worldview, or type of consciousness that encapsulates these behavioural characteristics? Because if there is, conservatives should be funding and exploring possible cures. And he lists various words, six of them. One, cowardice. Two, hypocrisy. Three, regressive. Four, totalitarian. Five, reality blind. Six, unawaringly, I'm not sure that's a word, self and civilization destructive. Nice try, Jack. I don't entirely buy into it. Number two, hypocrisy is the easiest. Yes, because increasingly, nothing the left does makes any sense. It doesn't matter what issues you're talking about. For example, sexual orientation is fixed at birth, according to the left. So you're gay from birth. So there's no point going along to one of these pray away the gay sessions, because it ain't going to work, because you're gay from birth. So jurisdictions are starting to ban all this pray away the gay type stuff. Whereas on the other hand, sexual identity, gender identity, that's just something you can choose. You wake up tomorrow and you decide you're like 68 years old or whatever Caitlyn Jenner is, and you decide you'd like to be a woman. Hey, go for it. That can be changed at any moment. That's gender fluidity. It's so fluid it can ebb and flow through the course of your life. Not like orientation. Or that your orientation's fixed at birth, but gender, you can change all you like. So we're happy to pump you full of hormones and lop off healthy body parts whenever you want. It doesn't matter that there are inconsistencies like this. It doesn't matter that, for example, every time some white guy kills a bunch of people, that's an indictment of every single white man in America. And if the white guy happens to have a flag or just a sticker of a flag on the back of his car, then that flag has to be banned and Dukes of Hazzard reruns have to be cancelled, as happened with the Confederate flag after the church shooting. Whereas every time some excitable young Muslim fellow goes Allahu Akbar and runs down a bunch of people in Nice, and runs down a bunch of people in London and blows up a pop concert in Manchester and shoots up a Christmas party in San Bernardino and shoots up a gay bar in Orlando and decapitates a priest in France, whatever it is, those are just isolated incidents. There's nothing to connect them all up. All jihad is local. And if some guy happens to have a flag in his car as the fellow who went to Allahu Akbar in Edmonton, Alberta, when he ran over a policeman and went all stabby on a bunch of people, he had an ISIS flag in his car. Don't pay any attention to that. There's no wider pattern to be discerned here. Dead people at the hands of a white man in America, that's an indictment of all white males, white male privilege, all the rest of it. A bunch of excitable Mohammedans every day of the week running people over, stabbing people, blowing them up, shooting them. Pay no attention to that. They're all unconnected incidents. These are the contradictions of the modern left. It extends throughout almost every aspect of anything that goes on, and it boils down to nothing other. What they all have in common is that they're at war. All they care about is, there doesn't have to be an internal logic to it. What matters is that it should hollow out, as I was saying yesterday, bourgeois values or middle class values. So the fact that their theories on orientation and gender are entirely incompatible makes no difference at all to any of them. But they're not cowards. Your first word was cowardice, Jack. And they're not cowards. They're boundlessly ambitious. And in that sense, that's the energy. Even when they don't have the numbers, they go for it and they find a way to get it through until eventually the numbers catch up with them. That's what happened with gay marriage, for example. The polls in the 1990s in America used to show that a majority of Americans were not just against homosexual marriage, they were against homosexual activity. They didn't care whether you got married. They were against it if a couple of guys just got a little bit frisky on a Saturday night. They were against it. And what happened, and no politician, as you know, from Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, no politician was willing to stand up and say, I'm in favor of gay marriage. And they figured out a way to do it. They figured out a way, essentially, to redefine one of the oldest human institutions on the planet to their convenience. And you can say that's a lot of things, but it's not cowardice. In a sense, as I was saying earlier about what William Wilberforce did two centuries ago, it requires a certain kind of courage to take positions that are unpopular and indeed for which there's no demand, because even gays didn't want to get married back then, and figure out a way to do something, figure out a way to get it done, until the point where, as we see in Australia, people don't even want to speak out against it. That's what's interesting to me about it, is that even people who are opposed to same-sex marriage have got the idea that it's kind of not quite safe to speak out against it these days, that you might want to rethink how outspoken your opposition is to that. And I don't think they're cowards. I do think there are a lot of members of so-called conservative parties in Canada, the United Kingdom, in Australia, in the United States, who are actually a lot more cowardly when it comes to standing up for what they believe. Andrew Coyne, another. This is another Canadian question. We can't just have all Canadian questions today, but this one comes from Andrew. Andrew Coyne in the National Post, my old colleague, suggested that we move to one global time zone. If we did that, you'd save a few minutes at the top of your show, wouldn't you? Well, it sounds a bit like the metric system, actually. I could well understand. With the metric, the imperial elements or American units and measures, you know, pounds and bushels, I love you, a bushel and a peck and all. These are human measurements, the feet, inches that are related to how people live their lives. And then some Frenchman invented the metric system, and it doesn't really bear any relation to the units which exist in people's lives. It's designed by a theoretician. You know, when it's cold, you can say, wow, it's 20 below today. And when it's hot, you can say, gah, it must be in the 90s today. And you can get a sense of that. And in the metric system, that's nothing. It's because it's just, you know, between 10 and 20. That's what happens when a theoretician devises a system. And I can see that the globalists, if they're going to get serious, might well impose a single time zone on the world. There was talk, I mentioned at the top of the show, that Britain is on a different time zone from continental Europe. Most of Western Europe is actually on something called Central European time. And all the businessmen in London 20 years ago, they were all urging the government to abandon Greenwich Mean Time, which is where from whence the world's time zones derive, and move to continental time, to Central European time. And they were arguing on business grounds, because like they get into the office, they like to get into the office around 10 a.m., and when they call the guy they're trying to sell something to in Germany, he's already left for an early lunch. So it makes it very difficult. And so they wanted Britain to move to the Central European time zone because it had done so much. It had done wonders for the Bosnian economy, and they thought we'd like to get a piece of that action. And it would have been great for tourism on the west coast of Ireland because they could have relaunched themselves as the land of the midday moon. It would have been a very if you were on the west coast of Ireland, that would have been a very interesting thing to go. But I'm not in favour of time zones. You know who imposed time zones on North America? This is for Americans and Canadians. It was the railroads. Because in order to develop a reliable train system, every town had kind of local time at that point. You just went by whatever the clock face on the local church said. And uniform time across the North American continent in time zones came about thanks to the railroads. But I'm not in favour. I know the globalists, again, it's to do with ambition, but I'm not in favour of one time zone for the whole world. I do not think that would be a good idea. Let's see if we can... Oh, yeah, here we go. It's all coming through a bit now. It's all taking a bit of a while, but the questions are becoming deliverable to me in an accessible form. Carla McAuliffe writes, "Hi, Mark, do you think the tide is turning a bit? As an American who has always loved football, I have to be very disturbed about the national anthem protests. Today I was happy with what appears to be Roger Goodell's letter to the NFL that players should stand for the anthem after President Trump turned the media coverage from protests about police brutality to being against patriotism and the military." Well, Trump won this one. Everyone said, oh, he's inserted himself into this. No, what was going on was absolutely disgusting. And I don't care about it. I mentioned this before. I mentioned it on the radio and TV. I think the level of discussion on this is nuts. A national anthem is a national anthem because everybody does the same thing when it happens. You hear the few the music strikes up and you stand up. That's what happens in a national anthem. It's not a particularly American thing. It's consistent ever since they began national anthems. I think the Dutch was the first one, if I'm remembering correctly. That's what's happened. In my own country, O Canada got the status of a national anthem on two occasions. One was at the dedication of the Vimy Memorial in France for the dead of the Great War. I think it was 1937, 38, and King Edward VIII, one of his few public engagements, because he reigned for a very short time before he went off, flounced off with Mrs. Simpson, he was dedicating the Vimy Memorial in France. And O Canada started, and he remained standing at the salute. And people thought, wait a minute, back in Ottawa, they're going, wait a minute, what was that about? Is he saying that O Canada has the status of a national anthem? And then a year or two later, George VI was at the dedication of Canada's War Memorial in Ottawa. And again, they started playing O Canada, and he remained standing at the salute. And from that point on, everyone has always stood for O Canada. That's what, it's a national anthem because everybody in the nation does the same thing for it. And here's where I react as a foreigner to the argument going on in America. That people have a First Amendment right. It's a freedom of expression thing. If you want to disrespect the national anthem, that's a legal constitutional right. Who the hell cares if it's a legal constitutional right? Who the hell cares about that? It's boorish and ill-mannered. If you want to protest police brutality, you've got 23 hours and 59 minutes throughout the day to do it. But you don't do that to your national anthem. It's just boorish and vulgar and ill-mannered and stupid. And it's nothing to do with freedom of expression. If my dog comes in and takes a leak over the casket during my grandmother's memorial service, that's also freedom of expression. But it doesn't mean I should be encouraging the dog to do it. There's something absolutely amazing in the idiocy from left and right of the discussion that is somehow it's all about what's legal and what's not legal. As I said, I quote Lord Moulton all the time because he was the last guy to talk any sense on this. If everything needs a law to say whether you can legally do it or it's illegal to do it, you're screwed. Your country's dead. It's over. Because what matters is what used to be the 80% of life that was just regulated by manners, by a sense of what's appropriate. And the NFL thing is nothing to do with what's legal. It's to do with what you should be doing. It's to do with what's ill-mannered, what's stupid, what's boorish, what's vulgar, what's half-witted, and what's got nothing to do with your flag and your national anthem. And I can hardly bear to watch, you know, even among my friends at Fox News or whatever, I saw Joe Namath today. Joe Namath regretting that somehow, Joe Namath regretting that somehow these nice players who'd drawn attention to police brutality and somehow they were, you know... Get real. If you demolish a national anthem so that a national anthem becomes an opportunity for self-expression, it's not a national anthem anymore. Okay, so we've got some people who stand up for the national anthem. We've got some people who take a knee for the national anthem. Maybe there's another group of people who'd like to do an interpretative dance for the national anthem. Maybe Harvey Weinstein would like to drop his pants and masturbate into a pot plant during the national anthem. Once everybody sees a national anthem as an opportunity for self-expression, it's not a national anthem anymore. And Trump was right about that, and that is why he is winning that. That is why he is winning that, and good for him, good for him. Jeremy Frankel says, "Hi, Mark, would you ever consider running for office one day? If so... why now and not earlier? If not, why not?" Well, I occasionally joke if I'm in Ottawa or Montreal, on stage in Ottawa or Toronto or whatever, about wanting to be appointed the next Governor General of Canada. And I'd quite enjoy doing that, just walking around reviewing troops and going to ribbon cuttings and things. The only reason I mention it is because years ago, when Michaëlle Jean, about 10 years ago, she was a lady from Haiti originally, who used to introduce pro-Castro documentaries on the CBC. And they decided to make her Governor General. And somebody wrote, I think it was in the Literary Review of Canada, if we have to have a third-rate Montreal hack for Governor General, instead of Michaëlle Jean, why can't we have Mark Stein? At least it'd be a laugh. And I was a little hurt by that, at the idea that somehow Michaëlle Jean as Governor General is something that's plausible and actually happens, whereas me becoming Governor General is self-evidently ridiculous. And I felt a little bit sad about that. And I thought there was Hugh Hewitt the other couple of years ago tried to get a little bit of headwind going, at, or tailwind, which is it? Anyway, a little bit of wind going, to see if he could get me in the running to be a senator in New Hampshire. I think to succeed Judd Gregg or whoever it was that was retiring at the time. And I think about that. But one of the things that I have no idea what the United States Senate does. And I certainly, the one time I had prolonged exposure to them close up during the Monica Lewinsky trial, I found it one of the most repellent institutions on the planet and would have no wish ever to be among their number. And I will say this, that one of the big points I've made, Jeremy, is that I'm a great believer in the Milton Friedman line. You don't wait to elect the right people to do the right thing. You create the conditions whereby the wrong people are forced to do the right thing. And that's how the left thinks about its issues. The left doesn't really care what, say, Hillary Clinton's actual view of gay marriage is, if she has one. I mean, she seems such an entirely hollow figure to me that if you actually knocked on her chest, you'd get a tinny echo. But even supposing that she does have any authentic views on anything down inside there, the left doesn't care about that. The left doesn't care that, you know, she genuflects to a bunch of God botherers and says that she believes marriage is between a man and a woman, and then 8 years later suddenly decides that she's hot for gay marriage. They create the conditions whereby the wrong people are forced to do what they regard as the right thing. And to me, that's more important. I think, than who gets elected. And by the way, I couldn't get elected to anything now because I've got a long, long paper trail of things that would, and unless Trump has really changed conditions, I've got a long, long paper trail behind me of things that would disqualify me from an election anywhere on Earth, pretty much, more or less. This question may have been rendered slightly obsolete. Jerusalem Falafel Rice. I don't know whether that's the town he lives in. I don't know what he's having for lunch. But that is the name I have here. Jerusalem Falafel Rice says, "Hey, Mark, what are the chances that Hillary will denounce Harvey Weinstein? Wouldn't that mean an implicit condemnation of Bill?" Well, it would, but she's shameless. And in fact, I believe she has issued a statement on him in shortly before this show began, because the story has accelerated ahead now. I believe there are three women, two of whom have given their names, who are accusing him, Harvey Weinstein, of rape. And Rosanna Arquette, the actress Rosanna Arquette, has said that she was asked to touch a part of Harvey Weinstein that Rosanna Arquette should never, ever, ever be asked to touch. And so the story is galloped ahead a little, and Hillary has felt obliged to condemn him. But you know as well as... Look, the sheriff down in Las Vegas, the Clark County sheriff, used a line about this guy Paddock, who killed everybody last week, and talked about a secret life. There's a lot of secret lives in America. There's a lot of secret lives anywhere. But actually, there's a lot of secret lives in Las Vegas. Las Vegas pretends to be this sort of Disneyfied version of Vegas. But underneath it all, as you understand when you hear about the prostitutes and whatever that that Paddock consorted with, that old Vegas of hookers and organized crime and all the rest of it is still there underneath the Disneyfied veneer. And that's true in Hollywood, too. I mean, these stories of what they did to cover up for Weinstein. This is why it's an issue not just for him. I mean, let's put it this way. I mentioned Disney. Disney owned Miramax, where the wine founded by the Weinsteins. So essentially, Harvey Weinstein worked for Disney for a lot of the time this was going on. Who paid off all these women? Disney. Walt Disney. Walt Disney in his freezer paid off all these women for Harvey Weinstein. So it's like a corporate decision. And you have a situation where this is really ugly stuff. This is, this isn't like some of these other stories that are out there. This is where he traps a TV reporter in the basement and he forces her to watch him masturbate. And the TV reporter agrees to stay silent on it. And the New York Times reporter, she's got the goods on totally phony baloney corporate positions that exist for no reason. Because like the guy in Miramax, Italy, who knew nothing about movies, his only job was when Harvey was flying into Rome for this or that, he had to find the girls for Harvey. So this is a corp. The Weinstein Company has fired the guy now, but there's all kinds of people in. There's women in that business who were subjected to Weinstein's behavior, and then there's all kinds of colleagues of theirs who were responsible for cleaning up the mess afterwards. And this idea that it is confined to him is not true. And what is interesting to me is that, in a sense, all modern progressivism has done is made the gap between hypocrisy is the complement vice pays to virtue, used to be the old line. It's become less tenable because virtues are so publicly worn now. So that if someone makes the wrong joke, like the poor woman who made an infelicitous AIDS joke when she was flying to South Africa, she got on the plane in New York, she had a job, she got off the plane in Johannesburg, her life was over. Because of one tweet, one joke, or you give a couple of hundred bucks to some group that believes in traditional marriage, as we now say, and you have to be fired from Mozilla. You write a thoughtful memorandum on whether there are biological differences between the sexes that account for their disparate, the differing interests in employment at high levels in the tech industry, and Google fires you. One memo, you're gone. One small three-figure donation, you're toast. One tweet, your life is over. And then there are other people, because we live in an age where virtue has to be worn 24/7 a day. In a virtue-signalling age, you have to beware any moment when you're not signalling your virtue, when you're betraying some older, grubbier inclination toward honest, bawdy humour, towards old prejudices. In a virtue-signalling world, you stop signalling your virtue for a moment and boom! It's over. So the gap between the compliment vice pays to virtue is wider now than it's ever been, which is why a pig like Weinstein, you know, a creature of appetite so gross that even when he has some of the most famous women on the planet, like Rosanna Arquette and Ashley Judd, he treats them like a used Kleenex to wipe up on. That is why I think the gap has kind of gotten wider. And interestingly, progressives just don't care because he's their guy. And that's how it was with Bill Clinton. He's their guy. And again, it goes back to the essence of the left. He's their guy, and as stained in semen as he is, they'll drag him across the line and prop him up because they don't abandon their guys until they have to. That was the lesson they learned, the Bill Clinton lesson. Well, then, we'll just have to win. Toby Pilling writes, "But what can we do, Mark, to change things? Politically, here in the UK, should I support an insurgent party like UKIP, or should I try to help convert a large established party, the Conservatives, from within?" Well, these situations are all different locally, Toby. But I think at a certain point, a political party that ignores its base does invite total contempt. And I think the British Conservative Party is at that stage. You know, it's a very elite thing. When the elite get out, that's what's fascinating to me about the NFL, for example, is that this is supposed to be like a sport for guys leaning back on the couch, cracking open a can of beer in the man cave for blue-collar white guys with beers in the lazy boy recliner watching the TV. And it's run by people. And again, this is the danger of what happens when you have too uniform an elite. It's run by people who are completely out of step by that. These owners just want to be... These owners want to go to a party and they'll run into Harvey Weinstein. And Harvey Weinstein thinks they're one of us. And the owners think Harvey Weinstein is right. They're all part of, they want to be thought well of by the people who are their social peers. And that applies in politics too. What's interesting to me is that someone like, that's how you wind up with a guy like David Cameron. That's how you wind up with Theresa May, who, as you know, 20 years ago was damning her own party as the nasty party. Theresa May often gives the impression to me that she thinks there are no principles with Theresa May. She's a very clever woman and she's gotten to be prime minister. And unlike Mrs. Thatcher, it's not because anybody thinks she is a once in a generation transformative political figure. She just figured out how to survive, how not to self-destruct, and how to get herself into number 10. But she isn't conservative. And the party that she leads is not conservative. And it's very easy to do as they do and rationalise each concession and say, this isn't the hill to die on, that isn't the hill to die on. And Toby, to go back to what Jeremy was saying, you mentioned UKIP. UKIP is wacky. Because it's very difficult to start a new political party. And when you do, most of the people who want to join it are wacky. So you end up with a party full of whack jobs. I had a conversation with Nigel Farage about UKIP to that effect. But it's basically the same if you start a new political party anywhere on the continent. Geert Wilders has said the same thing to me too, to one degree or another. It's very difficult to start a new party, and the system is designed to prevent new parties being started. Not quite to the same frozen degree as the United States is, but all systems, it's a club, and you don't want to let anybody into the club. But look, to go back to Jeremy's point about elected office, look at Nigel Farage. What did he ever get elected to? Couldn't get elected to the House of Commons? He'll never be Prime Minister, never be Foreign Secretary, never be Lord Chancellor, never be Home Secretary, never be Chancellor of the Exchequer. He will never hold one of the great offices of state. And yet he accomplished something that no recent Prime Minister, Foreign Secretary, Home Secretary, Lord Chancellor, whatever, has managed to do. He reversed the entire thrust of post-war British foreign policy, all but single-handedly. He decided 20 years ago this was what mattered to him. Not getting elected, not becoming a junior minister for this or an undersecretary of that, but that this, getting Britain out of the European Union, was what mattered to him. And he pulled off more than anyone. He was responsible for that result, that Brexit result. So, because of the 20 years, regardless, I'm not talking about the campaign necessarily, I'm talking about the 20 years he put laying the ground for the referendum campaign. So, Toby, my view is this: conditions are always difficult, but at a certain point, parties outlive their usefulness. And when the gap becomes too wide between them and their base, then my view is they deserve to be punished for it. You know, I don't like the Republican Party, and they're a do-nothing party. And it's salutary once in a while to remind them that there's a price to be paid for that. And I hope that that's something to take into account. I mean, it's different in every constituency here. Michelle Dulac writes, "Dear Mark, could you comment on the insistence on the press of invariably describing every outlying party in Europe as far right, to the point where it seems to be embedded in their style manuals? I mean, UKIP, the Front National, AFD, the Lega Nord, so far as I can see, all they have in common is an antipathy to the EU and to unrestricted immigration, both translating roughly to please don't take my stuff. My thoughts exactly, but in the US, I'm not far right." Well, you're absolutely correct, Michelle. And if you think about these things, and this goes back to Pim Fortuyn, just after 9/11, when he was murdered in the Dutch election, he was described as far right. In fact, he was a gay hedonist, and he was concerned about Islamic immigration because it puts a style, it kind of crimps the style of gay hedonists. If you notice, there aren't a lot of gay hedonists in Riyadh. Not a lot of gay hedonists in Yemen. It crimps the style. But because, as you say, he stood against the multicultural blather where we're meant to pretend there's no internal contradictions, he was damned as far right. Geert Wilders, who is a Judeophile, which is rather unusual in the new Europe, is also damned as far right. So he's made to sound like a Nazi, even though he's a completely different view of Jews on it. The Front National, and this is interesting, but here in America we have this thing. People think the sweet spot to be is socially liberal but fiscally conservative. That's what all the so-called electable Republicans are. Your Arnold Schwarzenegger in California, or your Christy Whitmans in New Jersey, or your Bill Welds in Massachusetts, or your George Pataki's in New York. And what do they all have in common? Yeah, they got elected, and 20 minutes later, it's like they were never there. I mean, has there ever been a more pitiful eunuch in political terms than old Mr. Muscles, Arnold Schwarzenegger? So and of course, the obvious problem with that is that in being socially liberal and fiscally conservative is that most of the social liberalism comes with a hell of a price tag. And what a lot of these parties seem to me to be is actually they seem to be actually fiscally liberal, but what you might call socially not necessarily socially conservative, but culturally conservative. Because there's no point being conservative in open borders, in an open borders world, because there's nothing to conserve. This is where the kind of Chamber of Commerce right in America is so stupid that you'll get a couple of years of cheap labor and you will never, ever, 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 ever elect a Republican again. And these European parties are threading the needle in precisely the opposite way. In other words, they're culturally conservative, but they're fiscally quite liberal. And in fact, what they are in some ways, I mean, for example, UKIP during the Brexit vote got a lot of old Labour votes that in a normal world would have gone to the Labour Party. But they decided that what was important to them was that they'd like to be able to walk through their hometown and for it still to feel like home. So they voted for Brexit. Now, that's exactly the same thing as happened in November in the United States. Again, the people who decided the election in three or four states were former Democrat voters who decided that the American dream was no longer working for them and they were willing to take a flyer on Trump. And there's nothing far right about that. If you look at Marine Le Pen's policies in France, for example, they're quite protectionist. But it's just that these days in Europe, everybody now who opposes Islamic immigration on the scale that Europe has seen it is described as far right. I spoke to all these women who were sexually assaulted all over Scandinavia and Germany and the Netherlands. None of them were far right or even right in any meaningful sense. But the minute they complained about being sexually assaulted by so-called refugees, everyone around them, including numbers of their friends, decided they were suddenly right-wing, that they'd suddenly gone over to the AFD or whatever. And not at all. And not at all. If it's a right-wing thing not to want to be sexually assaulted, then Rosanna Arquette and Ashley Judd are extreme right-wing because they didn't want to be sexually assaulted by Harvey Weinstein. But that's what it's got to in Europe, that if you oppose the suicide of Europe, you are far right. And that's not going to play anymore. And that's actually, to my view, one of the most... I was shocked by a lot of things, particularly in Germany. I was shocked by the media not reporting it, the sexual assaults, after I'd spoken to these women. I was shocked by the police trying to bury it in the paperwork. But what shocked me most of all was the friends and office colleagues of these women who were embarrassed because they thought these women complaining about sexual assault had somehow gone right wing. That's a point to remember. In the end, they will abandon all the feminism. In the end, they will be like Donna Karan saying that if Harvey Weinstein drops his pants and masturbates in front of you, maybe you shouldn't have worn that dress. And they will actually do that they're already doing it with those so-called Muslim refugees in Europe. Paul Coletti says, Mark, what do you make of what we saw in Catalonia tonight? Mr. How do you pronounce this guy's name? Puigdemont? I'm not really much of a Spaniard or much of a Catalan. Pulled back from a full independence declaration. You wrote recently that the Catalonia situation was indicative of a wider acceptance of EU malaise. However, I see the Catalans as real fanboys of the EU. They want full membership and all that entails. No, I didn't actually say that. There's a malaise in Europe, and people want different lots of people in Europe want different arrangements. So, for example, England wanted to be out of the European Union. Scotland, Northern Ireland, Gibraltar, they wanted to stay in the European Union. In fact, Scotland, after Brexit, wanted to be a full member of the European Union in its own right. This is one of the clever things that the European Union has done in its diminishment of the nation state, has been to bulk up the regions. There's some committee of the regions that they have in Brussels. I think it's about 20 years old now. And you can go and look at how they've got, sometimes they've got the countries divided into actual regions. For example, Northern Ireland is a province and Wales is a principality. But if you don't happen to be broken up into regions, the European Union will break your country up into regions. And the regions all get to send members and sit on this committee, and they get to be pretend foreign ministers as if they're representing real countries, going to all these banquets, black tie banquets, having a grand old time like a miniature UN. And that can get seductive. Now, in Catalonia, the government pulled back from a full declaration of independence, in effect because Spain threatened to send in not terribly pleasant forces to keep them in the country. And so they pulled back from the brink. But my point is that as dissatisfactions grow in Europe, people are going to be redrawing the boundaries of what they regard as home and what they regard as salvageable. And when I wrote about this, I mentioned after the Irish talks in London, when the unionists, Sir Edward Carson and the other fellas in Belfast, and they started drawing up their boundaries for the part of Ireland that would not be joining the Irish Free State. And people said to Sir Edward, well, why don't you take the whole of Ulster, the ancient nine-county province of Ulster? And he said no, because he couldn't hold... He knew the Catholic population in three of those counties was too big and that he couldn't hold the line. And he wanted a defensible perimeter, so he took six counties. And he felt that was all. And as the last 90 years have proved, 95 years, he was pretty sound in that. And that's the way people are going to be thinking, that you already hear this talk that London is lost, for example. It's just too multicultural now. It's over. And that what matters then is being able to find somewhere. That's how the East Germans are thinking. Can you defend your little bit of turf? And big countries are an unusual phenomenon. In the last 20 years, we have seen, what do countries do? Soviet Union breaks up. Yugoslavia breaks up. Czechoslovakia breaks up. Why should that only be confined to Eastern Europe? And it doesn't matter what you feel about Catalonia or whatever, that remains a question. Why should that phenomenon of the modern era only be confined to Eastern Europe? And I think that is one of the interesting features there. William Stroop. This isn't really anything to do with what we were talking about, but I mentioned on the Greg Gutfeld show that Rob Halford of Judas Priest had once hit on me a long time ago in a pub in Wolverhampton. I was a lot cuter then, didn't have a beard. And Rob Halford had not yet come out at that point, but everybody knew he was gay as a goose. And I said on the Greg Gutfeld show, because I like show tunes. And so I said, a gay heavy metal guy hits on a heterosexual show tunes guy. How screwed up is that situation? And you gotta figure it's really bad luck for Rob Halford, because the minute I was talking about Judy Garland or Ethel Merman or whatever I was, he must have thought he was in. He must have thought that was a surefire. Anyway, Anyway, William Strook says it's not the most important thing, although it is not unrelated to civilizational collapse. So William Strook writes, "Hey Mark, so Judas Priest Rob Halford hit on you. That must be the most metal thing that's ever happened to you. Could you give us your thoughts on heavy metal? And perhaps review a few albums like Priest's British Steel and Iron Maiden's Number of the Beast." You know, I think British Steel might be my least favourite album title of all time, for reasons I will explain on another date. But no, I'm not going to do that. If you find Iron Maiden turning up as our Song of the Week, William, you will know that Western civilization has just entirely slid off the cliff. I don't mind heavy metal guys getting flirty with me in the pub, as long as I don't have to listen to the music. That's my bottom line on that. Thank you for all your emails. I'm sorry we had a few technical problems at the moment, but at the start of the show, but the hour's flown by, and we will get to some of the ones we didn't get to when we get a bit more organized in a video edition later this week. But thank you for joining us on this live audio edition. It's 5 o'clock Eastern, 10 o'clock in London, midnight in the Middle East, and I hope you're enjoying your breakfast in Australia. We will see you next time.